Welcome to The Rest is Education. I'm Ross Borthwick, and this week I'm joined by Vicky and James Eales, and we're discussing the hot topic of boarding in education. Vicky, James, great to have you on the show with us this week. Now, would you care to just introduce yourselves?
Yeah, good evening, Ross. So I've started off my relationship with boarding as a student myself. So as a seven-year-old, I decided that I wanted to go to a boarding school within my prep school, and my parents found out basically by a matron saying, I hear James is boarding. And then I spent 10 years in a boarding school myself as a student. And then from then on, I've had a relationship from as a gap student, as a prep school in Gloucestershire. And then when I started teaching, I've been teaching for 17 years. 15 of those have been within a boarding house, either being assistant housemaster or head of boarding. And then two working within a prep school, but not within a boarding house direct.
I was a day pupil at a school that spent most of my time wishing that I was a boarder, because it seemed that all the fun things happened as soon as I went home at the end of the day. I then got a job. My first job in teaching was a residential post. So I was a graduate gap and house tutor. From there, I went on, became an assistant house parent, did a maternity leave for a head of boarding, and have worked alongside James's, supporting him in his role of head of boarding. So I think in total for me, I've lived in boarding houses since 2010, maybe with a couple of years out in the middle of that.
Blimey. Okay, so you're definitely the people to be speaking to then in terms of experience. And obviously, I'm actually speaking to you from a boarding house. And as you know, I run a boarding house. You're far more experienced than I. But it's interesting to hear about your different routes into boarding. I think probably for most people listening, they won't have boarded. And I imagine that the concept of a boarding school is something that David and I touched upon in the previous episode of perhaps almost fictional, you know, this sort of mystic world of boarding houses and sort of old schools with mottos and you know, maybe that perception stemming from Harry Potter and similar works. And so I think probably the best place to start is actually at the beginning, in terms of where did they come from? Where did boarding schools come from? And I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of them sprung up during the Victorian era. Certainly the vast majority of those that are still around today started during the Victorian era. And that there is a stereotype, isn't there, that, you know, they were basically established as centres for educating the children of empire, whose parents were perhaps overseas, particularly working in the civil service abroad, the colonial office, or in the armed forces, and boarding schools provided a solution to having children educated somewhere safe at home, and providing a British education whilst the parents might have lived overseas. And so that's sort of the stereotype. Does that ring true with you guys and where you imagine boarding schools to have originated?
Definitely, yeah. I think having worked in a couple of boarding schools, with very much have that ethos around them. And I think also it does still play that role, as in supporting parents. And my parents were in the armed forces, and that's primarily why I boarded from a young age, was to give me stability. I was quite lucky that my parents were quite close down the road, so I got the best of both worlds. So they could come and watch me play my sports matches, etc. But also I had the benefit of boarding as well.
That's something that maybe not many people are aware of, but there are funded places, or certainly partially funded places, for pupils who are children of serving sort of armed forces officers, certainly, and different schools also have different packages for NCOs. In a way, that the stereotype might sort of have a bit of a hangover then. But actually, I'm just going to try and smash that stereotype, in that boarding schools existed before, long before the Victorian era. In Chelsea, so relatively small part of London, in 1834, so pre-Victoria, there was 28 boys and 46 ladies' schools offering boarding. A school in York back in 1818, so not long after Waterloo, a boarding school there in the centre of the city offering boarding to 70 pupils, which is a bit bizarre, because you often, with both of these models, Chelsea and York, they're very urban. So you tend to think of a boarding school as somewhere sort of off in the green fields out in the countryside, offering a bit of fresh air and exercise. And, you know, these early examples are very, very urban. But then, of course, it goes back even further, doesn't it? So you go back to sort of medieval times, and you've got boys being sent to monasteries or noble households. They're learning sort of classical subjects like Latin and theology, and they, you know, they're being sent often great distances. So you've got early schools, you've got King's School Canterbury back in the 6th century, you've got King's Ely, you've got Winchester, obviously fairly famous 14th century, and then, of course, Eton, who everyone's heard of in the sort of early 15th century. And all these schools would have drawn people from actually great distances to go and then stay. They're definitely pre-Victorian as a concept. I wonder then actually what it is that drew people to boarding schools. It might have changed at different points in time, but
I think currently it's kind of boarding, sort of stereotype of boarding, of kind of your boy or girl being dropped off by their parents beginning of term and then not being seen by their parents until X year, half term, or even the end of term, like it used to be. I think that concept's changed hugely. And I think that's kind of where boarding in the UK has evolved, in that it's kind of moved with the times. So we offer sort of day plus boarding. So we have day students who come in and board for two or three nights a week, flexi boarding. And that kind of fits into kind of the way that the society has changed. And in terms of the needs that the parents have, many parents, obviously, we know, work very, very hard to pay for the fees to go to independent schools. And therefore, they need the flexibility to be able to go to work in another country for a couple of days a week or up to the city. And so that's something that I've seen change a lot in my years of working in West Country boarding.
Fundamentally, parents have seen boarding schools and independent schools as trying to do the best by their children, whether that be putting them in the best location, keeping them safe, or in terms of getting a good education. And I still think that's still very high up people's list of things they want to achieve by sending children to boarding schools, is that they want to provide the best opportunities for their children.
And so if we think sort of historically over time, people were willing to do that, you know, as we've just discussed, you know, back in the medieval period, people might have sent their children off to boarding school. But then, unlike today, they might not have seen them for much longer periods of time, whereas I think what we're saying is that the model has evolved even fairly recently to offer sort of shorter periods where pupils would board so they would get to go home more regularly.
Yeah, completely. I think that's having sort of come out of COVID, where you had some students literally being stranded in the UK. And also we were at that point, we were working out in Switzerland as well. We had some students who literally could not physically get home. And schools stayed open to offer them the care that they needed, because in effect, you are their parents whilst they're under your care.
If we just think about maybe the point when you qualified as a teacher or decided that teaching was for you, what sort of took you into a boarding school? Because obviously most teachers wouldn't contemplate it.
Yeah, so when I was in a boarding school, when I did my graduate teacher program, so my teaching on the job qualification, for me, what attracts me for boarding and what made me want to do it is because I benefited hugely from it myself. And so I wanted to make sure that the children within the school had the same sort of care and benefits of what I gained from it. I look back and think I had stability. I had great fun. I met some of my closest friends at boarding school. I don't see them for 10, 20 years down the line, but when we meet up, it's literally like I'm 18 years old again. And it's that sort of relationship that I have really appreciated. And I think going into the boarding school environment and working there it's hard work, but actually the benefits of it is huge. And I think actually it's just so nice to get to know the students really, really well. So it means that actually being a teacher alongside looking after them in the boarding house means that you really get to see them develop as a human being, and really helping them kind of set up for whichever direction they want to go for in their life, that they can achieve what they want to achieve.
The pupils won't really care what you know unless they know that you care. And so working in a boarding environment, you've got increased opportunities to make that rapport, to build that sort of relationship with the people. Certainly from my experience, the pupils are far more interested in hearing from you academically, you know, because they know that you're on their side. So how about Vicky, what drove you into boarding?
So I kind of fell into it when I was interviewed for my first post. They asked whether I would be interested in living on site, and being fresh out of uni and super keen, I said yes, definitely. And actually it came something that I really loved. I've always been a PE teacher, and so living on site, what they wanted me to contribute to the boarding life to begin with was some extra sports things in the evening. So I ran a whole host of tennis clubs. I used to open up the swimming pool, and it just meant that those kind of things that you did during the school day could be carried on into the evenings. And actually they were the things that all the children were excited about after supper. Can we go out to the AstroTurf? Can we go to the swimming pool? And it was just really good fun. And I think from there, I was happy doing that kind of role and saw what it could bring to the children as an extra. And yeah, definitely thought it was a good place to be in the evenings.
See what you're saying, and I have a sort of similar side to my role here, that I've opened up the swimming pool, let's just say that. but what you're saying about all the stuff in the evening, it's quite funny because I've had conversations with parents at prep schools, day prep schools, where the parents are vehemently sort of anti-boarding. They then spend the evenings as effectively a glorified taxi driver for their child, driving them from sort of after school club to the friend's house to the, you know, to do the homework and then find supper somewhere. And then, you know, suddenly it's bedtime, probably an argument or two along the way, and then you've got the child up first thing the next morning and, you know, back on the school run. What they miss sometimes is that the evenings at boarding school are providing all the same things that they're rushing around trying to provide themselves. It's often done as a collective where the pupils are with their mates doing those things that they want to do.
I think for another way to look at it is we kind of talk about how we want children to be children for as long as possible. Yeah. And I think everything's being discussed us as a society about sort of too much technology time, being social, kind of well-being, everything that kind of post-COVID and before that. And to me, that's what boarding school allows you to have, as in we have devices that the children hand in to us that we charge them basically to keep them safe. They can phone home on a Tuesday, Thursday and a Sunday night. However, if it was their like mum and dad's birthday or their parents need to talk to them, that's not a problem. They can phone as well. But it just means on the other days of the week, they can basically just be children. They focus on just being friends, playing with their friends, reading, music practice, doing whatever they want to do. We had a recently inspection a year ago, and the guy who came in, who oversaw the boarding, kind of had this preconceived idea of why do we restrict their phone time? And I explained to them, he said, okay, I understand it. And it wasn't until he met with the boarders and they said that's what they really like about it. And that was the point where his opinion changed, was because the children are just very, very happy with that model. And then I think when I talk to parents about it, they are sort of very grateful for that because it reminds them of probably their childhood before we had mobile phones and devices.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for those listening, obviously you're working in a prep school setting at the moment. So your oldest pupils are 13. And, you know, it's perhaps most people at home are thinking, well, you know, it would be great to limit their children's devices at that age. And I think in the senior setting, you could argue that, you know, pupils have a bit more access to their phones. And there's a big discussion in education more broadly about what to do in terms of device restriction. I know they're being banned in the classroom full stop in England. And then some schools north of the border are taking quite a firm stance. Gordonston has just said they're banning phones outright. And, you know, phone policy, I'm sure, is being reviewed in a lot of schools globally right now. The UN guidance on what screen time is actually doing in terms of pupils' development is quite worrying, particularly with regard to their ability to focus. And I've had conversations with pupils just this past term who've said to me that they couldn't possibly sit down and watch a film because they don't feel as though they can concentrate for that long. Moving the conversation on. So fortunately, and this is something that I didn't expect, the number of pupils in boarding has actually grown So in the, I was just looking at the, so it's the ISC, so the Independent Schools Council, they do a census every year. And the 2023 census, the results show that there were 66,325 pupils in boarding on the day of the census, which was the 19th of January, 2023. And that represented 12% of all pupils in ISC schools. And that was an increase on the previous year of 1,093 boarders. Okay, so that's quite an increase as a percentage annually on the previous year. And so clearly, it's not just us in boarding that think that boarding is great. You know, other parents are also coming to that realization. Why is that? We've touched upon the technology. You know, maybe some boarding schools offer more of a sort of Swallows and Amazons type education and being far from the sinful city. You know, we're 14 miles from the nearest pub. you know, that is definitely something I bring up on tours. You know, so what is it about us and why are we attracting people? Do we think that growth is all domestic? Is there an international element to it?
I think there's got to be an element of international market coming into that. But I also think maybe that people aren't having as many children as they used to have now. And actually, if you can afford to send them to a boarding school, they are getting that wider family community. You know, if you're in a prep school boarding house with 40 other children of similar ages and interests, it offers a different dynamic that they might not get at home.
I think currently our boarding house at the minute is about 50% English and 50% international, which I think is actually a really, really good split, because actually you've got English as the main language. So it kind of helps the international students learn the language. And that's kind of fundamentally one of the reasons why they're sent abroad. But at the same time, because the world is so interlinked, international, it means that someone who has been brought up in the West Country has got the chance to learn to live with someone who's got very different cultural needs, religious needs, etc., and it kind of makes you, I think, a better human being in terms of probably more tolerant,
more rounded,
more probably self-reflective as well. I think it's kind of when you're in a dorm full of 8 people. I've had some funny conversations recently about one boy who keeps snoring and the others are kept up. And it's kind of, it opened a whole can of worms in terms of where the conversation went. I wasn't expecting it, but actually that was just something that goes, I snore. What do I need to do about it? And it was quite a nice conversation for sort of 12, 13-year-old boys to reflect on living together in a dormitory.
What we're saying is then maybe it works both ways. So there's a growth of the middle class in that perhaps we know for a fact there are more people that are higher earners than there were, say, 20, 30 years ago. There's a lower birth rate. And so then those people who are now considered higher earners are likely to have fewer children, and so they might be able to then afford to send their children to independent school. And we're saying that maybe if you live in a part of the country which isn't that multicultural, then sending your child to a boarding school might actually allow your child to become more rounded than if they were to go to, say, a local school that didn't have such a sort of international cohort. But then you've also got the idea that actually some of these numbers in terms of the overall growth must be international, in that there is that sort of like British education as an export, albeit you know at home as well.
People's understanding of what a boarding school is, as it's no longer cold showers, bullying, sort of that sort of era, which was a horrendous time, but actually it's a home away from home. And everybody wants to make boarding a really positive experience for A, the boy and girl in the boarding house, but also the parents as well. I think that's something that I spend a huge amount of my time emailing parents. And I joke with some of them, I'm basically their son, daughter's PA, because I'm the one organizing when they're going out for birthday parties or inviting a friend into the boarding house because that's what that happen at their home. So I think that possibly might have an effect on the increase in numbers of boarders, because actually people are seeing it as a positive thing.
The stereotype of a boarding school is that it is fairly rigid and you have to conform to their framework. I think that's very different in modern day boarding. Like James was just saying, we bend over backwards to make sure that the children get to any birthday party that they want to, that, you know, if there's a hockey club in our local town on a Friday night, if we can, we'll take a minibus there and, you know, enable them to go and do those things. So I think boarding schools now are really flexible and are trying to work to meet the needs of today's children and make it work for parents as well. So whether that is that they're not full-time boarders, that they do a couple of nights a week, or they go home every weekend, but they can't be at home during the week because mum and dads are away. I think that flexibility now that boarding schools offer is really desirable to lots of parents.
I think student voice, which obviously we've seen that a lot in education, is kind of the thing that's really positive. I think for me, if I compared what I had in my 10 years of boarding as a boy compared to what I've seen the other side, is I can't remember how many times I was asked as a young 10-year-old, what would I want to do? It was more kind of like, this is what you're doing, and you just got on with it. Whereas now you kind of think student voice is so important, as in we give board for the week. So our boarding staff put forward a name. They get an extra piece of tuck for that week, a certificate, and they also get to choose what meal they want on Saturday night. And it's just a way of a recognition in a positive way. And when we brought that in a couple of years ago, it was a real massive hit, where every week some of probably, if you asked a teacher what the child was like, they'd probably say, oh, they're quite a naughty boy or girl. But they were the ones who were really going, fine, kind of who is boarder of the week this week? And there was a massive buy-in from it. And then with that buy-in, obviously it became positive, and there was a huge amount of positivity. So it just made life much easier for you running a boarding house, because it meant actually people cared. And I think for me, that's, community is really important. I think to comparing living at home with either a brother or a sister or an only child to compare to boarding school, where you are a member of a community. We talk a lot about that and saying we are a family community. And if you break something, own up, it's a mistake, it happens. But actually, what's the greater impact on the society? So we have, like, none of the boys or girls lock anything away. It's just a given that that is their personal space, and therefore that's respected. And if someone gets that wrong, then you address it. But actually, they all get it because they don't want someone else rummaging through their stuff, and vice versa.
We've sort of touched upon maybe the academic benefits of some schools, in that parents might be happy for their children to travel if they feel that they're getting a superior academic education. Vicky, you spoke about all the fun things that happen after hours and, you know, weekends, and basically like the greater extracurricular offering that you might find at some boarding schools. And certainly the ones that we've worked at are, I think, pretty tremendous in terms of the offering. And then you're now really touching upon what I think is the single most important factor, and that's pastoral care, and just the fact that actually you see the child in so many different lights, and the whole team get to, I suppose, form an image of that child, develop that child. We talk about being in loco parentis. What does that mean? I mean, I say to the boys in this boarding house, while you're here, I am your father, you know, and that is something that, you know, I think they quite like to hear. And when I say things to them, it's because I want them to develop, you know, and you try and put yourself in their shoes, don't you? And well, you've actually been in their shoes, James, but
I just don't agree with that. I think they just want someone to A, care about them, and show that you are willing to fight their corner. Because we are all get it wrong day in, day out as adults, and they are just young children. And I think if you can stand up to actually, yeah, you got that wrong, but I will go and kind of stick up for you and kind of say, he got it wrong, but he's really sorry. I think for me, that's really important. As well as the small things, there's kind of, I had recently a boy who, his grandmother passed away. When I reflect on it, I just spoke to him about my experience when I was his age, similar scenario, and just gave him someone to listen to and talk to. And then actually, at the end of term, he wrote a note saying, thank you very much for listening to me. And actually, as only when I reflect, actually, I didn't do a huge amount for him, apart from just gave him someone to talk to and a little bit of reassurance. And that was actually all he wanted. And for me, when you kind of talked about kind of why I want to be in boarding, to me, that is one thing that makes me feel really pleased that I'm in boarding, is that how actually that has had a positive impact on that child and will help them probably develop as they grow older and kind of how they deal with scenarios, situations which aren't always positive.
Anybody that's worked within a boarding school very quickly realizes that it's not the kind of job that you can do unless you really care. You're there to provide the best possible opportunities and care for the children that you look after. And if you don't buy into that 100%, you'll quickly realize that a boarding school isn't the place for you to be.
Clearly, there are academics sometimes. There are extracurricular and there are pastoral benefits to boarding. And we're seeing boarding growing as a sector. So that's going to require more teachers entering the profession. Do you think boarding's for everyone, if you think about just the teacher?
I've worked with people who've been fantastic house parents who have come from state education. And when they joined an independent school, that was their first experience of boarding. And I think it's because of that mindset and kind of their personality. I personally think whatever what your background is influences whether you can or can't make a success of boarding. I think it just comes down to you wanting to do it for the right reasons and get and enjoying it. It's hard work, but actually there's so many positives from it. And I think actually enriches my work experience in terms of I can walk into a geography classroom and I can speak to them and you see them doing well or helping them doing some prep in the boarding house. And for me, that's really rewarding.
If you are someone that works in a boarding school, there are definitely some staff that like to draw a line at the end of the academic day and, you know, and go home to their families. But I think it's really important that anyone that works in a boarding school has a good understanding of how the boarding provision works and what it does to enhance the school and how important it is to those children that live it. So I think even if you don't want to be a residential member of staff, if you work in a boarding school, I think it will only enrich you to take an interest to try and gain as good an understanding as possible of how it works and what it brings to the children that live there.
And I think that's good. There's lots of different ways of models of a boarding house running successfully. But one I really do like is when you've got academic members of staff coming in and doing an activity session evenings, because it means that they can come in and, for example, do a hobby that they love. So I've seen one where a teacher's coming in and does circus skills. And if he hadn't done that, then none of the boarders would have known that he just loves juggling and messing around as a circus instructor. And that was a passion that he could share. And then we had some boys and girls off of that who actually really developed their circus skills. And that's just something they've tried, loved it, and they've kind of embraced it. And that's become part of them.
Yeah, there's so many examples of that. You know, I talk from my own experience of being on the Astro, the tennis courts and the swimming pool, but the joy it brings to some children if they get an extra hour up in the art department with free rein over some pastels that they wouldn't get to use in a normal lesson. You know, it really kind of, it can incite a love for things that because you've got that little bit of extra time with the art specialist or with the PE specialist, or, you know, the head of music's there and she knows you've been having music lessons, but she hasn't heard you play and she listens to you or helps you. It's all those added extras that can make such a massive difference.
Yeah. And certainly in this house, we have tutors in most nights during the week and they'll meet with their tutees as well as everyone else in the house, but they'll do something specifically academic with those pupils. And again, you know, we're in an older setting here, but certainly thinking back to boarding prep schools, having those members of staff who weren't directly involved in the boarding come in to run something, I think that always went a long way with the pupils. And my experience of that was that I certainly got, as I've mentioned earlier, like something back from the pupils in terms of that rapport, the understanding of how it all works. You know, for instance, you're not going to set a meaty prep on a Wednesday night in the build up to the inter-house play, because you know that that's when the day pupils are in and they're rehearsing. So it's like having that understanding of how the school works. If you didn't set foot in a boarding house, I think it would be quite difficult. Right. So were saying, James, you mentioned earlier that essentially anyone can work in boarding, in that your experience doesn't sort of prejudice you against having a successful career in boarding. But then is it for absolutely everyone? Would we be responsible for, let's say, someone sort of naively entering the sector thinking that it is just all about juggling with the borders and having a match tea? I'm not sure I'd be comfortable with that on my conscience.
It's like everything. I think from a professional, it's kind of what do you want to prioritize? Like when I've done boarding and I became head of boarding, it was a clear understanding with my, before I was appointed, that I wanted to still carry on teaching in the classroom. I love teaching geography. So being head of geography, I still teach 2 year groups of geography and games. The drawback is that sometimes you're up late at night doing things that probably you wish you'd done earlier on in the day if you weren't on duty. We all like to do everything as well as we can, but sometimes just making sure actually some things you just can't do, and you've just got to prioritize what that is. So sometimes my marking is not done, when actually, because actually I think my priority is to be with the boarders, and also I think it's that work-life balance of actually you don't want to run yourself into the ground, because that's not good for anybody. We've all worked in schools where that hasn't been accepted, and therefore everybody has a really not enjoyable time. Whereas my current school, there's a really, really good ethos where if I needed extra time to do something, then that time would be found to do it within the working week.
It's definitely not something to be entered into lightly. It is a massive responsibility, depending on what level you enter at, that you take on board. But I think if you go into something with your eyes wide open, and you do expect that it's going to be long hours. I think for me, that's the thing. I always say it's not always hard work, but it is long hours that you're putting in. And, you know, like you said, I might have taught a whole academic day, been away for fixtures, come back, had 5 minutes before everyone goes to supper, and then you're into the evening routine, and then the duty phone rings at 2 a.m, and you stay up for an hour or so with a child, and then your alarm's going off at 6:30 the next morning because it's time to go again. So I think for me, you've got to be realistic about the hours that you'll be working, and balance that up against what you'll get out of it.
But I think, like, just going to the point what Ross just said was, if I was a young teacher entering or starting my career and you're interested in it, I think it's just trying to basically find out about it, even just going to the boarding house voluntarily and sort of just get a flavor of what you would be doing. And I think that would be a good starting point. If I had a young teacher who came to me, I'd say, you just come in and have a look, spend an evening with us, even an hour, just see what it's like. And then they can make their own decision of actually if there's something they want to pursue or not.
I think when I first started working in boarding houses, the school I was in had 3 different houses, and I was quite lucky that I did a night. So I did 3 nights, 1 in each house. And so for me, I worked under 3 different house parents. And I think that was an invaluable learning tool for me, because these were people that had been in their profession for kind of 15, 20 years already, seeing how they approached things. I think for me, it was great CPD almost, to spend that extra time with colleagues that, you know, we all try and go and sit in on someone else's lesson once a term or whatever, but actually working that closely with other colleagues was a really valuable experience for me.
I think for me personally, I was very lucky when I first became a teacher. One of the governors at the school was one of my old geography teachers. And he said, you're going to have great fun. They're going to make you a really, really good schoolmaster, not just a teacher. And I think that I saw some really good modelling that, A, the head of boarding was superb. And the two heads that I worked under, first of all, they had come from a boarding background, and they put boarding at the centre of the school. And I think, therefore, I've been quite, my time to becoming head of boarding has been quite a long progression. But actually, I think it's really important, because it's meant that I've seen lots of things done really, really well, and also things done not so well. And then it means actually then when you get the opportunity to run a boarding house, you can pick and choose what you've seen that has worked well and then bring in your own ideas as well to develop what you think is really important. So I kind of think actually over 15 years of boarding, 10 of those, I was working under someone in the boarding house, but then at the same time being given opportunity to run the boarding house when they weren't on duty, which is something I really enjoyed doing. I remember years ago when I first was quite new to it, the head of boarding ran the French trip. So he went away for a whole week, and it basically meant that I just ran the boarding house for the week. It was full on, but actually it was really nice to do something where you were basically solely in charge with the matron. And that gave you a real flavor. Actually, I really enjoyed my week doing it.
I know, certainly my assistant housemaster here, when as you've it's not quite going away on the French trip, but if I'm away for a night or so doing something, I think he really relishes the opportunity to be in charge, and then that's developing him. And you know, he, I'm sure before long will want to be running his own. And and he again is one of these characters who, a bit like you said, you know, he's a schoolmaster rather than just a teacher. You know, his role in the school is 360. And I think are drawn into boarding. That tends to be a bit of a rule in terms of who will succeed. That was a really good bit of advice about maybe before committing to something quite as big as working in boarding, maybe see whether you can experience it a little bit first. And it might be that for those working in, let's say, a day school at the moment, it might be that they can do that after hours. You know, they could go and volunteer or get a bit of work experience in the evenings, perhaps at a boarding school before committing to actually applying for something. I don't know about you guys, but I would massively welcome someone interested in doing that. We talked about sort of work-life balance. Finding the time for yourself is very important. And Vicky, you talked about the hours, you know, the round-the-clock nature of the role. Often we're given a reduced timetable if we're running a house, but if we're a tutor in a house, we might not have such a reduction. And in terms of our own well-being, I've seen several different takes on that and different cultures and different schools. And so it might be that before committing to joining the profession, you would need to know a bit about the culture in the school that you're hoping to join. Would that be fair?
In 15 years, I've seen a massive change. So that's 15 years. Five of those were at an international boarding school. Probably before I left the UK in 2015, there was probably a lot of kind of, you just work hard, play hard. And it was just expected that you got tired at the end of term. You probably finished the term off ill, and then you use the holidays to recharge and you go again. And then actually when we were abroad for 5 years, there was a really, really good work-life balance. And actually, we had a whole day off in the week. And that was just as an assistant house parent. We didn't work every single weekend. And that made sure that we were, A, fresh every time we're on duty, and B, we had time for ourselves. And I think actually, it's like every job you do, the longer you do it, the easier it becomes. And I think one big difference for us abroad was actually we're in up a mountain in a ski resort, and people could go skiing midway through the day. No one frowned against that because they actually knew that actually later in the evening you'd be on duty. And I think in the UK, there probably possibly are still schools out there, but that's not seen as a dumb thing. Whereas I know at the minute, if I want to go for a bike ride in the middle of the day, I could go because they just trust you to manage your time. And I think that's really important because that escapism from work and out of the goldfish bowl is really important.
I think if you have a leadership team that has at one time or another worked or lived in a boarding house, they understand what is expected of you and therefore have quite a lot of compassion. You know, if you have had a really tough couple of days, we had a delayed flight a couple of terms ago that meant that I was up until 3 a.m. putting kids to bed, and I just had a message going, don't worry, your lessons up until morning break are covered, you know, get a lie and sort yourself out. And it's that human touch that makes a real difference to people, and definitely not my weakness that because I was up until 3 a.m. waiting for a flight to land that I needed a lie. And it was just like, no, how can we make sure that Vicky lasts through the next week without becoming ill or needing some further time off? It's kind of self-preservation as well, knowing your limitations. And it being okay to say, I'm absolutely knackered. I need a couple of hours here or there to do something for me or just to have a bit of downtime.
What about Ross at length as sort of leadership? This is sort of going on a bit of a tangent of kind of how important leadership is within education, within schools. And I think it's just an exception that if your assistant house parents are going, they've had to go away from school for personal reasons, that you as head of boarding, you step up and cover the duties, because that is being a leader. Sometimes you just got to take it on. And likewise, we've been in a situation where we haven't been able to be at the school, and therefore the assistant house parents have stepped up and they've gone above and beyond, because that's what they want to do. And it comes down to kind of pastoral care and why you're in boarding, and sort of it links it all together.
The leadership are having a good understanding of what your role encompasses, and the fact that it isn't a 9-to-5, it does need a lot of flexibility, and that's a give and take relationship.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're very fortunate here at the moment in our leadership. But, you know, for instance, the option of going for a run during a point in the day when I have the option to do that, and that not being sort of frowned upon, I think is fantastic. As you say, it's that understanding from the leadership that actually when most people do their exercise first thing in the morning or last thing at night, it's when we're at our busiest, really. Good. So we've talked about drawbacks, whether it's realistic. You know, if we were going to try and sell it, are there any major perks of working in independent boarding?
I think it depends on where you are in your point in your life, as in you are in a situation where you are being paid potentially as a full-time teacher with limited outgoings because the bills are covered by the school, because you're living within a school doing your job. So when I was younger, it was a great help to basically get a house deposit for something that's really hard these days. I mean, we worked abroad, lived in, enjoyed a higher salary than you would get from being in the UK. And as a result of that is that we could buy our first house. And so for me, I think that's the massive perk of it. I think in terms of like your career progression, I think it's really good for your CV. Personally, I think even if you just do it for a few years as an assistant housemaster, housemistress, or a boarding tutor, I think it's another string to your bow.
Depending on the school that you live in at, you can be incredibly fortunate. I mean, between us, we've now lived in 3 incredible manor houses or estates, and a purpose-built new build. When the school holidays come around, you suddenly have these extensive grounds that are pretty much yours, with a couple of other families to share them with, maybe. You know, you have an AstroTurf, you have a swimming pool. That's a real privilege to live in some of these old buildings.
Quite often we will go and play tennis or with the GAP students, things like that. It's just something you just do. It's a bit of fun, but it's on your doorstep. As in, you can go for a swim, hit a golf ball around the grounds, whatever you want to do, go and play music in the music.
Head up to the woods and eat the pizza oven. It's a bit of a fantasy.
Yeah, you're an adult still at school.
Where I've been fortunate enough to live and work, it's the combination of having that experience that people would pay probably quite a lot of money to do. You know, if you think about people spending money to go on a retreat or to Centre Parks or, let's say, Creef Hydro down the road for all these experiences, you know, and it's just there on your doorstep. It's that combined with the lack of commute, the lack of overheads and outgoings, and also the sort of the social factor of living on site with other people. And I know that some people might not see that as a benefit, but you know, when the previous school that we worked at together, I couldn't go out to the garage without having about 3 conversations with people. And for me, I loved that, you know, and it was a very sociable environment. Yeah, I know people who've lived in London for 20 years and they've never spoken to their neighbor. So, you know, it's the benefits of living on site actually sometimes are not to be sort of underestimated. I think particularly, you know, if you're bringing up children as well, and then your other option wouldn't be as attractive, I think it can be a huge thing. You know,
what I loved about being abroad for 5 years was every single day felt like a holiday, even though we were working, because everything we did was new, different. We would be doing it if you actually pay to go on holiday there. Something you just touched on before. I was chatting to someone out in Thailand, and because of the cost of living, they got paid 2 teacher salaries, the UK equivalent. But actually, it meant that they could live off one very comfortably and go, because they're basically the center of Asia. They go on lots of beautiful holidays that actually open so many doors. So I kind of have the conversation now with younger teachers saying, actually, the international market is brilliant. There are some really, really fantastic boarding schools, day schools out there. You've got nothing to lose. We left the UK for 5 years, came back, and the UK independent sector hardly changed. in terms of the ethos and kind of what you are buying into. But actually going abroad, I think actually really developed us as teachers, practitioners within a boarding environment as well. So I think, yeah, if you have an opportunity to do it, I would say go for it.
Definitely. I think the international market kind of exploding as it has is now offering so many opportunities to people, and it just brings a whole new element to teaching and the lifestyle that you can have with it. You know, it wasn't uncommon if we had a weekend off that we would pop to Italy for the weekend, or we'd pop to France. And now we're very lucky, we live in the west of England, we might pop to Cornwall or Devon, but it's a slightly different vibe.
And occasionally up to Scotland, maybe not for the weekend. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about boarding growing in Britain, because I suppose we've got the facts at our fingertips in terms of the ISC report, and it's quite easy to analyze that. But then what you're saying is that actually, because of the growth of international schools, or British international schools, but other models as well around the world, that boarding actually is increasing globally.
It's something that I saw when I was at school myself, where we opened an international school in the UK, and that was quite new at that point in time. And then now you've got obviously international schools spring up everywhere. I was talking to a friend who's in this sort of work area, and Japan has got one of the highest number of international schools. And you say international schools because people say British international schools, but actually you can go to one that's based on a British model, and it's fundamentally is like basically walking into a school with a similar architecture to what you'd find in the UK. But at the same time, you can go to a school where it is kind of modeled on the local culture. So the school that we're at in Switzerland, it opened as a British international school, and then within 2 years it changed, and it's very much dropped the British side of things. English was the main language, but it kind of really brought into basically being in the French-speaking part of Switzerland and really being international as well. And I think that's kind of the market it's looking at. And then it's offering IGCSE and then IB. But then up to that point, from an academic teacher's point of view, I really enjoyed it because I could create my own curriculum. And that's something I found really exciting, was that actually I could look at, instead of saying, right, you've got to follow this curriculum, I could pick and choose what I perceive to be the best topics for the child or the curriculum. And so when I look back, that's something I hugely appreciated at the time.
And I think that the IB is becoming more of a serious contender in the UK. And what you're saying about the opportunity for individual teachers or departments to create that curriculum content, I think is huge, isn't it? And obviously was formative for you, but it's something which a lot of teachers and maybe schools, maybe even parents, might be quite wary of, because in terms of, I suppose, the rigor of that, they're having to put an awful lot of trust in an individual. And, you know, I know I've seen your stuff and it's fantastic and it is brilliant. But and I personally have loved it when I've created my own resources and things like that. But I can see that might be quite intimidating maybe for some people starting out.
Yeah.
But so what you're saying about like the international school market, it's out there, it's growing. It could provide a huge opportunity for someone in education or someone that's thinking about going into education, and not just for the boarding or the lifestyle side of things, but also in terms of them as a professional and developing their teaching practice, perhaps creating their own resources and that sort of thing, maybe even having more time to do those things.
Yeah, definitely. Time is one of the main essence I think we gain from it.
Yeah.
I think also it's kind of the flip sides of the international schools, but what they're doing for our domestic market, as in many of the international schools that are opening abroad, is bringing money back into the UK to offer the bursaries. And I think it's such a hot topic now that many schools are kind of proudly saying, these are the number of bursaries we are offering. And therefore, it's making the independent market in the UK more inclusive. I think it's something that it's all linked. But when you talk about why is boarding numbers increasing in the UK, it's become classless in the sense where it doesn't matter your background. You are just accepted, whether you're a parent or a child. I've had experience of a parent, and they definitely didn't come from an independent background. and they were very nervous of letting their 7-year-old son start to board, and it's kind of working with them. But then 6 months down the line, they were really pleased that they'd done that because they'd seen how their son had changed for the better and how actually they have just kind of been accepted in the school. So all these preconceived ideas are actually very, very wrong compared to what they might have been 100 years ago.
I certainly saw that at the previous school that we worked at together, where at the junior end, the full boarders from, say, London, their parents tended actually to have, as you say, not been through boarding themselves, but they were very attracted to boarding because it offered the pupils that sort of that green experience and the freedom, I suppose, to enjoy and the innocence of the environment. And they, as you say, you know, maybe were quite nervous at the beginning, but really bought into it, and they could see how happy their children were. To bring it back to what you were saying about money coming back into the UK, I've been quite staggered by the number of bursaries and scholarships that are being offered by independent schools. And I don't know how many, particularly here, we've got a heck of a lot of full scholarships for things. And I just think that's fantastic. And I think those that have a scholarship, even if it's a partial scholarship, let's say it's a music scholarship and it's worth 10% off their fees, what it often does, and I think this is the case in lots of schools, is it opens the door to bursaries, which are then means tested on household income. So Christ Hospital, I think either 100% or close to it in terms of offering scholarships and bursaries to their pupils. I think they're in a position to do that because they do have a large endowment fund from when the school was founded in the Middle Ages, which they've not eroded very much. And so they do have an income they can draw down upon. But I just think, you know, lots of these schools, not even just the ones with charitable status, tend to offer something.
I think I've seen it from working a very small, I mean, by 230 students, that sort of size prep school, where we always offered at least one person a full bursary to go through. And it's like a rolling once they came out at the end of year 8. So when they're 13 and moved on to senior school, their next school of choice, the next cycle started. And actually it was something that was really nice to see because it gave an opportunity to someone who they had to justify why they wanted to do it. And they had to offer something positive to the school, whether that's kind of sport, music, academics, or an all-rounder. But then that just gave them an opportunity.
And I suppose lots of schools might have it in their charter that they are striving to increase the numbers of scholarships. And I think, you know, it's difficult in lean years, but, you know, I think a lot of schools, they are trying to go that way. And when I think about, in fact, three of the schools I've worked at previously were quite, that was one of their missions, if you like. That was their purpose, to grow that percentage, which I think is a pretty noble thing to do. Now, we've talked a lot about independent schools. I just wanted to flag the fact that actually there are 32 state boarding schools, and the fees there are only for the boarding. So the education itself is provided by the state. I wasn't quite aware that there were 32. I knew they existed. There are a couple sort of rural ones in Northumberland. They tend to be in more rural areas where maybe pupils would otherwise be doing quite an arduous commute every day. There's quite a famous one in Malig on the west coast of Scotland, where the pupils come from the Small Isles and they stay for a fortnight at a time at the boarding school, and then they go home and see their parents sort of for an exeat weekend every fortnight. So they're not all independent. They're not all fee paying. Sometimes they're serving a practical purpose in terms of, you know, logistics, and they might offer differing amounts of the other things that we've talked about in terms of extracurricular provision. But I think, you know, regardless of what their purpose is as a school, I think in the 21st century, we've talked about it a lot. It's pastoral care, really, that is the main thing that you would see. And I think maybe that's the difference from maybe the stereotype of, as you mentioned, James, the cold showers and bullying. So looking ahead then, what's the future for boarding, do you think?
I think it's got a strong future down in sort of our neck of the woods. There's definitely a stronger market for boys over girls. And I don't know what the reasons are for those. Maybe that some parents are a little more reluctant to let their young daughters go to boarding school. Whereas we've seen that actually for the young boys to go, there's been a bit more of a acceptance that they want to go. I think it's quite challenging in terms of the political sphere at the minute as well. Hopefully by doing this podcast is one thing that we've kind of put across as the many benefits of boarding, whether that is, like you said, the either state boarding or independent boarding, because when we have this discussion about potential VAT on fees, it's very much down to people's perception of what the independent sector is, and not fully understanding the whole sector. My sister works in a state school, three of my cousins are state school teachers, and we've had lots of long discussions about it. And actually, it comes down to you just want to give the child in front of you the best education. And I think that's, to me, really important.
I think if we look at how far boarding schools have come from the stereotype that lots of people have, that the future is really bright for boarding schools. Like I said, people only work in these institutions if they really care. It's not because of the massive paychecks that we get at the end of every month. You do it because you love it and because you want to provide something special for the children in your care. As long as people like that want to work in boarding, that the future can only be brighter and stronger. And I would just encourage anyone that hasn't visited one to go and visit one, get a feel for what it's actually like, not Mallory Towers or Hogwarts, and just go and experience one. You'll be made to feel very welcome. And hopefully it will give you another insight. You've maybe had a little bit of insight from this podcast, but a further insight as to what these places are actually like.
And I think it's the sector as well. The sector is very good at sharing. I quite often my counterpart, a fixture, is either head of boarding, work in a boarding school, and they're always more than happy to talk about the challenges you're facing as a boarding sector or things that are working well for you. And it's kind of working together to basically make the boarding sector model as appealing, as strong as we all think it should be.
It's how the schools really relate to society. And I think as long as they are relevant and that there's a need, then they will do well and continue to grow. And I think, you know, what is it that they provide society? It probably differs school to school, but you know, if you take some extreme examples, you've got sort of Gordonston's fairly famous fire brigade, haven't you? You know, the pupil fire brigade. And, you know, but I think, you know, it's how you link to the community, how you add value. And I think the best advocates, as you've said, James, are the pupils. And that, you know, that inspection you had, the inspector had a preconceived idea of what a boarding school was like. And actually that was blown apart by the pupils, you know, talking about their time at your school. So I think, as you say, Vicky, for anyone interested in boarding, go and visit. And, you know, there are open days all the time. And just go and have a look and ask some questions, but particularly speak to the pupils and see what it is that they say. Yeah, thank you for your time this evening. And I know that you're both very passionate about boarding and sort of keenly aware as well, listeners at home, that this is a bit of an echo chamber because, you know, we're very much sort of preaching to the choir here in terms of our views. But I'd be interested to know, you know, if anyone does want to ask any questions, we can put those to James and Vicky and get some answers for you. If you'd like to email in, we're at therestiseducation@gmail.com. We're also on LinkedIn and Instagram. And so if you want to get in touch, please do. And guys, thank you once again for coming on. It's been a
real pleasure talking about it. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having us, Ross.